How much of a slice of this pie are you guys aiming for?
It's challenging, but it's a use of risk management expertise in a new market.
It's like wartime movement of human capital into energy transition related activities.
If anything, the IRA has created a number of shortages of labor. It sounds like a joke, but there might not be enough lawyers. And what's funny is that a year from now, that battery, which again could be the largest battery in Texas by volume, it might not be the 10th largest battery a year from now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Modo the Podcast. In today's episode, Quentin is talking to founder and CEO Andrew Warrench and managing director of trading Nick Dazzo from Spearmint Energy. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit like, subscribe, and all those good buttons. It really means the world to us. Let's jump in.
Okay, Spearmint. Where did the name Spearmint come from?
That's a question we get all the time. I've named companies in the past, and it's always a challenge to find a name that's unique, memorable, and applicable to the industry. When we started, we were very focused on the environmental attributes of storage. And so we wanted something that evoked a feeling of green, of nature, and vibrance. And so we went through a couple of different options, but we very quickly came to the idea of something that's minty, and it's something that's bright and cheerful and energetic and green.
Do you have much mint down there in Florida?
Is it, you know, believe it or not, you have mint everywhere in the world. And so it translates in every language in the world. And, the sort of other way of thinking about it is mint is very invasive, and it really overtakes every garden and forest that it's planted in. It sort of quietly takes over.
There's quite a lot of subliminal stuff there, which we could unpack. We'll do that later. Andrew, Nick, firstly, just want to say a massive thank you for taking the time out to come and speak to us today. What you guys are doing right now is pretty ambitious, and we're really excited to have you on to talk to you. I'm going to kick it off straight off. I mean, what is Spearmint? What's the vision, and where are you guys headed?
So both Nick and I have been in the industry for a long time. I've been a power modeler for at least the last 15 years. And in modeling the grid, the most interesting aspect is that there really wasn't ever storage. You had some pump storage hydro, but it's the only commodity out there where you had to supply and consume the same amount at the same time, unlike other markets where you had tanks and granaries and silos. And so it affected the supply and demand and the pricing and everything related to electricity. When battery energy storage, or specifically lithium-based storage, became price competitive and the market realized the value of storage and started adding revenue streams to various regulatory markets, all of a sudden the revenues went up and the cost came down and storage became economic. And so as soon as those two things happened, I was heavily motivated to go out and launch a storage business right away. And that's really the genesis of Spearmint. It took price of lithium-based solutions. If you see just a few years ago, you had 10 and 20 megawatt solutions because they were the only sort of costly way of doing things. Now you have 500 and 1,000 megawatt solutions coming. And that's because the combination of low cost, better technology, and higher revenue sort of all came together.
Just a bit on how Spearmint fits in is the trading aspect, which I think is somewhat unique. There are other folks out there that are willing to warehouse all the merchant risk that comes with owning batteries that they build, but there is a mentality within most of the development community that's kind of akin to the renewables development industry, which is, yeah, we know how to take on construction risk, early development risk. But once this thing is close to commercial operation, we want to shed that risk either by selling it or finding someone to take an offtake through some, PPA. And that sort of risk-averse mentality is common in the battery development industry as well. And that's different from our approach.
Yeah, I mean, I often think if you're going to go to all the trouble of understanding the macro and volatility and how electricity markets work and this, this S-curve of lithium ion and all of the complexities of it, and go through all that pain and then build the site and then hand off all the upside to someone else, It seems bonkers to me. But yeah, it happens a lot. And so from Spearmint's point of view, what's the, you guys are doing developing assets, building assets, operating assets, and trading them too. I mean, where are you headed? What's the big vision?
You know, the big vision is one, when we first started, you know, I knew that this was going to take really three different pillars to be successful. One was understanding the markets and the trading side. Well, that was the genesis of it, that the market needs storage desperately. More solar and more wind means more volatility, the intermittent nature of their generation. It needs a solution, right? And so whether or not you're doing it for the carbon or grid resiliency or for price, you know, storage solves a lot of problems. And so from a trading side, it was an obvious need. And then second, I understood that both out of US, Europe, and Asia, the interest in investing in ESG-friendly infrastructure, whether it's Article 8 funds, Article 9 funds out of Europe, or ESG out of the US, there was an enormous amount of capital that was looking to deploy in the US. And so you have this new technology and this problem of intermittent resource and then the storage to solve it, a huge amount of capital that wants to invest in the space. And so we brought those two pieces together first. And the first, I think, three or four people we hired were from the development world. I previously had owned assets. I understood what it was like to own, operate physical infrastructure. And so it's really those three pieces of sort of the finance side, the building and operation side, and the trading side. You need to put those three together. And that really is what Spearmint's all about. Long term, because we are ESG compliant in multiple jurisdictions, I believe that the industry is moving towards a place where all off-takers will need to be compliant. And so many of the banks and existing trading firms who currently trade coal, oil, gas, other thermal products will find themselves out of favor as hedge counterparties for renewables. And so long-term, I think as a ESG-friendly compliant firm, Spearmint will be able to provide offtake to solar, wind, and storage, package everything up, and be able to provide a carbon-free 24-hour power solution across the grid.
So if I've got this right, Spearmint does developing assets, you fund on balance sheet, is that right? Actually, this is a good point to say congrats on the recent deal. I mean, that was absolutely
Thank
huge.
You.
And I'm sure there was a ton of work that went into making that happen. Do you want to just talk about that deal for a second before I move on?
Sure. I mean, the transaction you're talking about is our delayed draw term loan facility, where we can use the capital in a very flexible manner for all sorts of things along the development process. Everything from buying land or getting options on land to funding engineering studies, deposits with the utility, battery deposits, early stage construction, bridge loans on tax equity and other financing. It's a very flexible development facility that is used to sort of fill holes at any point in the process while we get our longer term loan facility, other tax equity in place, and the capital can be recycled in a manner that it just moves on to the next project. And you know, we believe the problem in the U.S. is so massive and growing, right? Storage deployment is slower than solar and wind deployment. And so the problem is getting bigger faster than we're solving it. And so we think that on a nationwide level, the need for storage is just so enormous that we need to take whatever development capital we can, plow it into projects. And as they mature and those projects get term financing, we reinvest that capital into the next wave of projects. I mean, there's a lot of research studies out there. And so the U.S. power market should get to between 100 and 500 gigs of storage over the next 15 years. And we are on the higher end of that in our forecasts. But that's going to require, you know, tens, if not hundreds of billions of capital over that 15-year period. And so the ability to use the capital, build projects, and then reuse the capital in the next projects is a great opportunity for Spearmint.
So you've got access to capital and it's go, go, go time. And so you find sites, you develop them, you build assets, and you do the whole operational package as well, right? It's end to end.
Yeah. I mean, we are also seeing demand from other renewable owners in the last few weeks. We've had some folks that own wind facilities and solar facilities who need the battery to pair with their existing renewable generation. in a way that can firm it up. And there are new requirements in Texas and other states coming to firm up your renewable generation. And that'll require pairing it with storage. We also believe that if you want to pursue a green hydrogen strategy, which is very popular in Europe and around the world and growing in the US, that you'll need to pair your battery energy storage with your renewable energy provider to qualify for that 24-hour matching.
So there's a lot of work still to be done. We're only just getting started. Nick, I want to go to you for a second. Nick, so I know Andrew comes from a background of modeling power systems. Nick, what's your background before we get into the depths of what Spearmint is trying to do?
I've been involved in energy trading for a long time, mostly on derivatives, financially settled contracts on oil and gas and all kinds of feedstocks for petrochemical industry, biofuels, and understand corporate risk management around those commodities, and kind of saw an opportunity here where, again, you know, this sort of risk-averse nature of most developers seemed to me to present an opportunity where someone who understands commodity risk can play a role and a more active role in managing that exposure. So some of what we did in our various trading activities around oil and gas was trading derivatives with asset owners, storage owners, and understanding their exposures. This is similar, but a lot more complex in the sense that it's not just arbitrage, it's participation in all of these other ancillary services. So it's challenging, but it's kind of a use of risk management expertise in a new market.
And I want to ask you about the state of the company right now, and then we're going to talk about what you're trying to build. So how many people are involved in Spearmint? And do you have assets live right now? Where are they? It's quite a new company, right? So where are you in your journey? And then I'm going to ask you about what have you got to do to get to the next phase?
Yeah. So right now, I think we're sitting somewhere around 30 employees. Our offices are in Miami. It's our home office. We have a second development office in Minnesota. We really like the development and engineering community out of Minnesota. There's a lot of talent throughout the Midwest at building things. Much of the trading talent comes out of Houston and New York and Austin. But a lot of the engineering and development talent we think is going to come out of the Midwest. We have only been operating for about 14 months, although we were incubating the business for quite a bit of time before that. And so don't let the 14 months of actual legal operations, you know, show. We've been focused on this for a very long time. I think if you look at the other friends of ours in the space, they've managed to basically almost double their firm in their second year. And I think that we'll be somewhere along that. All the renewable firms in the US are growing at a rapid clip of 50, 40% a year, if not higher. The number of people required to build so many projects really does grow pretty rapidly. And so, you know, I think despite the fact that there's probably 20 good renewable developers in the US, given the size of the problem on the carbon and the instability in the grid, you probably need twice as many developers out there.
It's a huge, it's like wartime movement of human capital into energy transition related activities. It's the scale of what we're trying to achieve this century is very easy to underestimate. So how do you build the company that you want? So 14 months, you've gone from zero to 30 people. I know you said you've been working on it before, but you've gone pretty fast. And so how do you get to gigawatt scale? And how do you get to multi-gigawatt scale? And what kind of things have you got to trade off along the way? I expect you have to outsource some bits and do some things in-house. How are you thinking about those problems from a perspective of building the business that you want to build?
So first, we're very focused on culture. We want people who want to be in the renewables industry, who understand that this is a unique opportunity to save the world while also making money. We've discussed in the past that 20 years ago when you graduated university, you may have wanted to go into investment banking or consulting or some other similar venture. 10 years ago, you were probably looking at tech companies primarily, right? Now people are graduating. I think something like 20, 25% of all graduates somehow have sustainability in what they're doing. And so there's an enormous number of people who want to go into renewable energy because they believe that they can help save the world and make money at the same time. And we think that's completely accurate. the quality of the candidates we get both out of school and from other industries is extraordinary. We're seeing a lot of hiring from big tech, especially on the data side. The utilities have always had a lot of data, but like most industries, they're still relatively new, incorporating AI and neural networks and things like that. And so there's great opportunity to borrow people from other firms outside of energy to come here and improve what we're doing. So culture is important. We do a lot of give back to the community and volunteer events. And so we're looking for people that have a certain mindset. We do have a sort of unique blend of sort of maybe a Wall Street focus on markets and more of a developer's focus on the environment and what's possible from a tech point of view. And so that is a big, you know, sort of driving force in how we hire. We do outsource a lot. We try and be efficient in our use of people because you can only grow so fast. You can't hire 500 people tomorrow and expect to maintain a culture and a level of quality and having people stay on mission. So smart growth is important. I think from the beginning, we've been very clear that to build new batteries across the U.S., it's going to take between 3 and 10 years to permit. Different regions have different timelines. There are some places you can get things up and running in 18 months. But if you want really large scale project, it could take you 3 years. And so when we launched Spearmint, we knew that that process, which we call a campaign, like a military campaign, to evaluate all the nodes in the U.S. and just define where we want to put projects, selecting the land, renting the land, buying the land, starting the engineering process and submitting to the local utilities, that's a 3 to 10 year process. And so what do we do for the first 3 years? We engaged in a process of acquiring mid-stage projects from other people. There's always been a history and culture of people finding land, submitting their studies, and then selling those projects because the return on capital is very high, right? But what we're doing is taking projects, buying it from those, what you would call a develop and flip shop, and taking that and finishing the projects, adding on our knowledge of the trading and offtake market, adding our knowledge of the financing and the tax equity market. And so it's really those two skill sets that we add, which allows us to buy those early and mid-stage projects and finish them. And so our goal has been to acquire projects. We started off in Texas. We've announced over a gigawatt of acquisitions in Texas, and we hope to have all of those online in the next 24 months or so, maybe less. And the rest of our acquisitions are focused more diversely, West Coast, Northeast, Midwest, and Central. And so it's really all about buying mid-stage projects we can finish up over the next couple of years while our own campaign comes to fruition.
So it's like two tracks happening here. One, which is incredibly patient and knowing that the stuff takes time. And there's another one, which is let's deploy some capital and get to gigawatt plus in the next 2 years, which are two kind of different mindsets, but coming at the same problem. So what does good look like for you guys? How you say a gigawatt in 24 months, that's pretty ambitious. How much of a slice of this pie are you guys aiming for?
So I think that part of the reason why, you know, we have these ambitious plans, we're focused on Texas, but as you said, we're patient. Part of that patience is to allow the construction team, the operations team, and importantly, the trading and analytics team to grow at the right pace, to be prepared to handle these gigs and gigs and gigs that are coming online. You can't just land day one and trade in 10 markets at proper size. And so it's giving the industry and our traders the ability to build out at the right pace. I think if other people like us assume that we are going to get to that 100 gigawatts to 500 gigawatts of storage, could we be 2-4% of the market? Absolutely. And so we could be 10 gigawatts in the next sort of 5 years, I think, and not really have a problem on sizing. I think there are some very large developers out there who are targeting 20-30 gigs. Again, maybe that's 10% of the U.S. storage market. And so I don't diversified regionally. And so I think that even at 20 or 30 gigs, we would not be too big.
And Nick, I want to ask you about, we're talking about taking the company from 0 to 1, or we're almost 1 to 10 here now. And for you to build a trading desk and an optimization team, really thinking about all the complexities of battery optimization that you need to cover, how are you building that organization and the capabilities?
You asked a moment ago about, you know, outsourcing versus insourcing, and that's a perfect example. You know, at our stage here, after a little over a year, throughout our trading development, we are dependent on others for things that eventually we expect to do ourselves. So optimization is something that we're building the capability in-house, but initially, almost certainly we'll be depending also on external providers to help us make those decisions. Similarly, for scheduling, you know, we could be our own scheduling entity, but initially there too, we are dependent on other providers for that service. Research, same sort of thing. We are building a research capability that will enable us to do our own forecasting. In fact, you know, we're well along in that process, but all of the research vendors out there that are providing useful services are of interest to us at this stage of the game to help us understand the decisions we're making in our optimization efforts. So I would say, you know, as is probably common throughout the industry, these early stages, we're outsourcing more than we will be, you know, just a year or two down the road.
And there's certainly a case for a company to be vertically integrated like you guys are building, that by bringing together all these things in one place, there are gains or advantages of integrating them. So if you can integrate your optimization and your scheduling with the folks who are doing operations and maintenance and are on site, making the site unavailable and doing maintenance on a schedule, then you can time that in a way which is optimal. There's lots of other examples where bringing it all together, if it's highly integrated, there should be marginal gains that all add up. We shall see. So next, I want to go to the business model. So Spearmint is a developer and an owner-operator. And so how does that long-term change compared to other developers? So, for example, the traditional developer model builds a business case with certain assumptions in it. Is your business case, does it look different because you're thinking end-to-end about the process rather than flipping it?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the develop and flip folks, they don't need a lot of people. It can be an extremely light business model to, especially if you have local expertise, to find property in your local community, run the studies and submit to the local utility and ISO. I mean, that can be done with 1 to 2 people, right? But from there, actually building it requires engineers, technology specialists, construction specialists, as well as project finance specialists, tax equity knowledge, and the capital to do it. And so it's a massive undertaking to go from sort of that greenfield early stage work and make things a reality. And then from there, trading around assets, if you keep the risk in a different company, sort of the trading entity is separately capitalized, it's its own business. So myself and many people on the team here have experience in running various businesses. We have people who have run Wall Street trading desks and hedge funds, people who have run development arms for other firms, CFOs from, you know, well-known renewable energy firms. And it's really bringing in the right people and letting them run their own departments is I think, the only way this can work.
To do this conversation without talking about the Inflation Reduction Act would be a big mistake. So how are you thinking about the IRA and how it affects your business? And there's an awful lot of opportunity out there. How are you thinking about capturing that?
So we focus very heavily on modeling the IRA, its effect on build out, over build out across the US. I'll tell you the incentives, especially if you locate your product in an energy community zone. And I will tell you that most of the products we see nowadays are being located in that 10% bonus zone to get the 40% credit. And then they're also focused on domestic content. They're hoping to get up to 50% ITC. Plus, additionally, you have some bonus depreciation from previous programs. And so if those tax credits can fund up to half of your project cost, obviously, it's an extreme tailwind in solving today's climate crisis. And so when we originally started Spearmint, we bought our first project, the IRA hadn't passed. And we were actually hoping to grow our pipeline and portfolio faster before the IRA or whatever the program would be would come out, just to scale up. we immediately saw after the passage last summer, the price of acquisitions go up, of hardware go up, of labor go up, and even of capital go up. And if anything, the IRA has created a number of shortages of labor. It sounds like a joke, but there might not be enough lawyers and engineers in the space. There's just not enough people. I was at a conference last week, and one of the lenders said that their team just can't grow fast enough to process all the requests for loans related to renewables. And so whether it's engineers, lenders, bankers, lawyers, staff, I mean, the industry is just growing so fast. And so all of this will take time. There is opportunity in almost every sector of the renewable energy industry. There's just huge opportunity for growth. And so no matter what you're doing or what part you play, I think everyone has an opportunity to be successful. And the IRA really is sort of the tailwind that's out there.
It's as a European, it's been quite remarkable to see it happen. I mean, over in Europe, we're used to having governments meddling in markets, and you kind of put one incentive in one place and you have lots of other things that pop second order effects that you don't really think about or are quite difficult to model. But it was quite remarkable seeing it in the US. But it looks like the money's been pointed in the right direction and is actually being extremely effective. But as you say, driving up costs of the input costs, capital costs, and labor shortages, maybe that's just a natural response for the kind of stimulus that we needed to do anyway to get the energy transition moving. But it's been really interesting to watch. And from a European perspective, it's quite exciting to see hopefully what Europe can come up with to contend with it. Watch this space on that one.
If I may, just on that topic, I mean, one way to think of it would be if, you know, you had a doubling in the carbon price in Europe, which would have a similar impact probably on all of those, sourcing markets, but for the comment Andrew made about lawyers. I mean, that's the thing about our system is we're not using carbon as an incentive. We're using tax credits as an incentive, and that's a specialized knowledge. So, you know, that constraint, having accountants and legal advice, is something that is really sought after. You probably wouldn't have to worry about that. But all of this, all of the other components would, you know, would presumably be similar if you just had a change in the carbon price over there.
That's a great parallel. I guess tax credits are quite a blunt instrument, but effective nonetheless, particularly if you're a lawyer. Okay, I want to talk about operating in energy markets. It's very rare for us to have folks on who come from both a modeling and a trading background. And I want to ask you some questions about the power market or the electric market in the US and how that compares to your previous experience. So, Nick, I know you come from a background of trading oil and gas derivatives or other feedstocks, you said. How is the world of batteries and renewables different to that?
Oh, it's a lot different. And, you know, it wouldn't be so different if it weren't about the unique character of storage, which is an arbitrage asset that happens to have all of these other services that are associated with it, right? So if you think of a gas cavern or an oil tank or a grain silo, that's a pure arb play. You are playing for time that might incorporate some understanding of, you know, regional disparities. So you might actually decide to charge or, you know, put oil in the tank with an expectation that after a couple of months, there might be some arbitrage to another part of the world. So it's not to say that it's all about time, but it is really just about what are the incentives for, charging and discharging. And it's on a monthly frequency. I mean, for all of these other commodities, it's a long-term game. There is short-term gas cavern storage that can move in less than a month. But generally speaking, the tools that one uses to manage that risk are monthly futures contracts. So here, you know, we're talking about certainly daily opportunities to charge and discharge, which, you know, that frequency alone, being hourly or sub-hourly, changes the game. But the whole optimization process, incorporating opportunities to participate in, you know, capacity markets, ancillary services, all of those things that the ISO will pay for, adds another level of complexity. So, you know, it's very different. And the research and the analytics that support it, you know, to me are entirely different. But the risk calculation and the understanding of sort of VAR analysis and stress analysis, that is similar. It's not the same, but those aspects of it come into play. And in that regard, you know, experience in other markets, I think, helps.
I've been in the power markets for 25 years. And I've seen them grow up from physical only markets with no futures contracts. In some cases, in ERCOT, when I started trading ERCOT, there was no nodal or even zonal or hub pricing. Everything was what we called undelivered, unplanned B, which was physical power, where you would literally rent or reserve the lines and move it from point A to point B and sell it. But there was no open market. So I've watched over the last 25 years, these markets get more and more complex. The one thing that I can, I can show you back to the mid 80s even, is that power is quite cyclical, and you have low prices. People stop building. You have high prices. People build too much. And then a few years later, they have low prices again. And so the cyclicality of power is something that we expect to continue, which is why you need to be regionally diversified. And each region really is, in many ways, an island, or at most connected to one or two other regions. And so it's important, while we're in ERCOT now, and we expect ERCOT for at least an extra 4 or 5 years to be quite a great place to play, you do have to be regionally diversified, just given the history of the commodity.
But do you have a target in mind when you talk about diversification? And you think about a portfolio of financial assets, and you think about, you know, some in bonds, some in equities, some in other stuff. How are you thinking about geographic diversification? Do you have targets in mind? You know, I want 30% in ERCOT, 30% in California, a bit in PJM. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the U.S. power market, ERCOT really is only about, 7-8% of the U.S. power market, but it does have an enormous amount of price volatility and evolution as load is growing dramatically. Places like California are much smaller, 3-5% of the U.S., but they also offer good price volatility. When you look at PJM, MISO, and SPP, you get closer to 50% of the U.S. from those three markets. And those three markets, while they have a lot of wind, they don't have a lot of solar. And so we think that over the next decade, PJM alone will probably have 100 gigs of solar, SPP and MISO maybe half that. And so the opportunity for storage to piggyback on that growth is just dramatic. And so and then you go to New York and New England, again, a smaller than Texas, but in some ways larger than California. Each one of these markets has different rules. It has different supply and demand drivers. I mean, New England is still heavily dependent on oil prices and in some ways, even European natural gas as a competitor in the winter. And so the supply demand issues at each region is wildly different, as is the weather patterns. Today, we're entering a weather pattern where Texas is quite hot and the East Coast and the West Coast are a little cool. Year over year, quarter over quarter, month over month, you have regional disparities in supply and demand. And in energy trading.
Only if someone sat in Florida could say Texas is quite hot right now. I think it's 42 degrees in Houston.
Yeah.
And described that as quite hot.
And to be accurate, it might even be hotter at one of our facilities we're building. You'd asked earlier about construction. We have one asset in late stage construction in West Texas, which I think if we're on track, will be the largest battery in Texas by volume. There'll be bigger ones by size, but not by volume. And that'll probably be the 11th or 12th largest battery in the world. And what's funny is that a year from now, that battery, which again could be the largest battery in Texas by volume, it might not be the 10th largest battery a year from now.
Yeah.
Right.
So
we're seeing stuff in California and the Southwest over a gigawatt in such in size. So when I talk about diversity, it's really because you have fuel mix diversity, regulatory diversity, weather risk, and they are quite different markets, similar to Europe.
And now I want to give you a chance to plug. So two more questions. Firstly, is there something that you want to talk about on the pod, an announcement or a new project or something that you want to get out to our listeners? And the second one is my favorite question, which is, what's your contrarian view? But first, let's go with the plug. What do you want to say to the world?
You know, one of the things that we may not have accentuated all that clearly in this discussion is we have this trading capability, and we've been talking about how it pertains to Spearmint's own development plans. But if Spearmint is successful in its development, it will also be a risk absorption agent for other developers, right? You know, we talked earlier about so many other developers out there that just aren't willing to warehouse that merchant risk and are looking for folks to take it off their hands. We are building a capability to absorb that merchant risk, not only of our assets, but for many others as well, and similarly geographically diversified.
So does that mean you guys would sign tolling agreements and provide a floor or a fixed amount of revenue, and you will take the risk on of optimizing the asset, and then the asset owner knows this is what I'm going to get for the next 5, 10, 15 years, whatever the time period is?
That's exactly right. We are in discussions now with, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 developers, private equity, asset owners that are looking for someone to provide offtake and manage their battery and provide risk offtake. And that's something that our trading team is heavily focused on today. The other shameless plug I would say is I've been focused on the sort of SFDR, Article 8, Article 9 investors for almost 7 years now. And what's amazing to me is that so many of the American developers, their view of ESG compliance is very limited. And so as a result, they have not put themselves in a place where they will qualify for ESG funds. And I think if you look at what we're doing, we've been following a little more of a European model. And so I believe most renewable developers, they think that because they're on mission reducing carbon, that it gives them sort of a green light in other areas of the business. And so we're heavily focused on not only giving back to the community and treating our people fairly, being transparent, doing no harm. I think we go a lot deeper than most other renewable firms. In fact, most renewable firms, if you really look at what they're doing, they're only an ESG investment because they're reducing carbon, not because they're running their business in a more ethical manner. And so we focus very heavily, and we spend an extraordinary amount of time planning our investment decisions and everything about what we do.
So ESG for Spearmint is much bigger than carbon reduction. It's the whole thing, and you're building and operating the business to ensure you capture every single part of that benefit that you can provide.
Yeah, I think the European, they lay out the rules, regulations, taxonomy in a much more complete manner. And not saying that it's all encompassing, but it provides a lot more direction and the ability to track what you're doing than you find in the US or Canada.
And now the fun one. What's your contrarian?
This is the best. This is my favorite one. So there are 31 gigafactories in the world that are currently under construction. They are all betting heavily on a global demand for batteries, not in the US, not in Europe, but everywhere. For autos, for power, for everything. The miners are, and the mining capital and mining growth is massively underfunded and will not be able to support all of those factories. And so as the US is growing to 100, 200, 500 gigs of storage, Europe will too, as will Asia, South America, and Africa. And so you have a lot of factories being built, but the mines will not be able to keep up with it over the long term. And so my contrarian view, which is it complete the opposite of what the National Renewable Energy Lab came out with earlier this week, is that battery prices go up, and they go up considerably. And so their demand, the global demand in Europe and elsewhere for solar and wind is enormous. That will require storage to go with it. And so I think that those investing in batteries today will find 5 years from now that asset has appreciated in value dramatically just for the mineral content. And so I think that is a contrarian view out there, and people should be racing to install batteries today while prices are reasonable.
So not just energy storage, but also mineral storage in these things.
I mean, mining itself is a tough, long business with very delayed permitting cycles and investment cycles, and they have their own ESG issues, which are hard to overcome. And so I think that the metals and mining sector is a real growth area of the world, especially to do it right and clean. And that will lead to much higher mineral prices, much higher battery prices, and sadly, probably delay the rollout of storage once we get past a few years.
That's a huge call. Love it. we're gonna go for a beer in 5 years' time, and we'll have to do some checks on this. I hope you're wrong, because the second order effect of that means it will diminish demand for storage, I think, and we'll end up using other things. But I mean, I guess it's good if you own assets that are going to appreciate in value. So there's a winner in everything.
If I'm wrong, it really just means that the solar and wind has been built out slower. Right. And that'll be sad. I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
If I'm right, the global transition to EVs, solar and wind happened, and the demand was so massive. And so I hope I'm right.
You know what? I changed my mind. I hope you're right too. And Nick, how about you? What's your contrarian view?
I'll go with the kind of, as I perceive it, the conventional view that before long, i.e. like 2 years out, we'll have battery saturation in parts of the U.S., including ERCOT. I think, you know, if you subscribe to any of the expectations that we've discussed already today in terms of the build-out of renewables continuing, even in that part of the world, certainly in that part of the world, you know, we have a perpetual growth in demand for storage services that will continue to provide a premium to those who are willing to invest in it. So we expect to utilize our trading capability to extract revenue from arbitrage opportunities in all of these markets. But even the ancillary services that a lot of folks basically take a very static view of and say, well, you know, if we build another couple of gigs in ERCOT, you know, we'll sort of wipe out that opportunity entirely. To me, doesn't take into account fully or even, you know, remotely the opportunity for additional need for those services that comes from the build out of renewables, particularly solar.
So another big call. So I guess to believe that, do you have to believe that the number of gigawatts of ancillary services that ERCOT is going to procure is going to increase significantly in the next couple of years alone?
I think that'll match the, if you get the solar and wind build out that we expect, you've seen people forecast the duck curve becoming a super duck curve, becoming a chasm, sort of in some ways like California, where you have you know, a lot of price spikes in the morning and then zero prices throughout the day and then a lot of price spikes in the evening, which would be great for batteries and also great for ancillary services as you have several times a day with massive inflection points. Power has always been about ignoring the long-term supply and demand in minute-to-minute dispatch and really looking at what the inflection point of the next megawatt is. And so even if it's just 30 minutes every morning on the morning ramp, and then the ramp down and the evening ramp and the ramp down, we believe the ancillary service needs during those periods will be extreme and growing, not shrinking.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
The one other thing that I failed to mention previously was power markets have always been path dependent, right? You have a winter storm Uri, people change the rules. You have winter storms in New England, you get PCM mechanisms. Over the next 2 to 3 weeks, you have an extreme heat wave forecast for Texas. Some weather forecasts are showing extreme heat. If Texas has another power crisis, which it certainly could over the coming weeks, it will force more regulatory change and force market dynamics to change. And sadly, we're forecast to set new all-time power records in ERCOT in mid-June. What could happen by late summer? And so one of the biggest risks to our business is a regulatory response that comes from another power crisis. And so in Texas specifically over the next few weeks, as you guys were saying, it's over 40 Celsius in most of the state and getting worse. And so by the end of the summer, this sort of continued heat wave, you know, it could lead to further regulatory change. It's sad, but that's unfortunately how power markets work, is you need some extreme event to sort of fix the market.
So surely Texas, of all places, the risk of that is lower, you'd think, because it's a free marketplace with light regulation, and that's in their blood.
over the last 3 years, ERCOT has twice changed its ORDC price curve by shifting it to the side. It has increased the volume of ORDC it procured. It's added an ORDC price floor in some hours. It's added an ECRS mechanism. It did add a price cap. All in all, ERCOT's probably made 5 to 6 market design changes in the last 3 years to incentivize changes to the grid, more storage, more power. If you have yet another power crisis, I feel that they will continue to evolve their process. Just 2 weeks ago, we joked that there was, 50 bills in the Senate with respect to changing the power market rules. Only really one or two passed at the end of the day, and one of those still needs a statewide referendum. So, depending on how things go this summer, it could force further action and further market rule changes.
Interesting. Guys, I just want to say a massive thank you for coming on. What a conversation. You guys have come up with so much that our listeners are going to love. So until next time when we can come down to Florida and do this face-to-face, I want to say thank you. And for anybody who's listening, please do hit like, subscribe, and all the good buttons. It means the world to us. Thanks, Andrew, and thanks, Nick.
Thanks again.